to introduction to tensor network methods. Today we have lecture 3 and 4. Today we go hands-on and try to learn how to actually use these methods. So we have these two lectures. The first one will be about describing the tensor renormalization group. Okay, this is an algorithm. This is the basic algorithm that later Benjamin and Bianca will tell you how to specialize to spin foams. So today we'll stick to the ISIM model. The first lecture we'll see, well, I'll describe the algorithm. We'll see what happens when we apply it to non-critical partition functions, the non-critical to the ISIM model. Then also what happens when we apply it to the critical ISIM model. And then I'll discuss briefly what happens if we apply it to three-dimensional partition functions. And then, if I have time, I'll mention some transfer metrics business that relates to some exercises. And then the second lecture, so lecture number 4, will be about discussing in which sense this algorithm gives rise to an RG flow, a renormalization group flow. This is also very interesting because sometimes we don't want to compute stuff. We want to see how our system, how our Hamiltonian flows towards certain simplified Hamiltonian. So that is what the renormalization group could do for us. And we'll discuss the flow realized by TRG, and we'll see that we actually have to fix it, and we'll fix it, and then we'll get another method called tensor network renormalization, which will define a proper flow in the space of not Hamiltonians, but tensors. Okay, but we'll be able to see this RG flow. Very good. So what we saw yesterday is that we can take the partition function and write it as a tensor network. Let me briefly review this. So remember, we had these Boltzmann weights, which were local in the sense that they only involve information about two neighboring spins. And for the ISIM model, this local Boltzmann weights could be represented as a matrix. Depending on whether one spin was up or down and the other spin was up or down, we would get four values that we could organize as a matrix. This was the matrix e to the beta, e to the minus beta, and so on for the ISIM model. And then we broke this matrix. We wrote it as a product of M and M transpose. And M was, again, a very simple matrix, which is for which we have an analytical expression in terms of the inverse temperature beta. And finally, we built our tensor, this blue ball with four legs, just by putting together four of these M's. Okay? So you did this yesterday. I was actually quite happy about how the tutorial went. I saw many, many people getting all the way to writing these tensors and start multiplying them and so on. So you know how to do this, okay? And then the story here is that the partition function in terms of Boltzmann weights, maybe in a 3 times 3 spin system, would look like a collection of Boltzmann weights, but we can just make the replacements in terms of N and M transpose, and finally we can make the replacement and end up with this tensor network, okay? This tensor network, which is an exact representation. This is a 8 times 8, possibly, yeah, 8 times 8 spin system. So the partition function is, for the ISIM model in this case, will be exactly represented by this tensor network. Okay? That's review from yesterday. Any questions at this point? Good. So to be clear again, we haven't computed anything. We just rewrote the partition function. And so this is an exact representation of the partition function. If we try to now just take all these tensors, put them together to extract the number, the partition function, we'll find that this is exponentially hard. If n is the number of spins, we'll still have that the cost, computational cost, is exponential in n. But if instead of doing an exact calculation, we give up being exact and we allow for some level of approximation, then we might be able to extract this number. And this one strategy would be to use Monte Carlo sampling, and you might now know everything about it. And the strategy we'll follow here instead is to not sample, but actually try to compute all these contributions by compressing them in some way, throwing away irrelevant pieces, and getting a number, which will be an approximate calculation. And remember that this is possible. This will be possible thanks to the partition function version of this ARIA law. Okay, there is this area law for entangled foreground states, which has an equivalent in terms of partition functions that will be the reason why we can efficiently but approximately contract this tensor network. Okay? So what's the basic idea then? The general strategy is that we'll take this tensor network and somehow we'll take blocks of four tensors and we'll replace them with individual tensors. Okay? These four tensors become this single tensor here. We'll do this through a coarse grain transformation. And then we can iterate this. So we can take this. We started with some tensor. If tensor was A, we'll call it A. Now we replaced these four tensors with a single tensor. Okay, this tensor is the different one. It's whatever comes out of this coarse grain procedure. And now we can iterate this, and we'll get a new tensor, A prime, and so on. Okay, so we go from having many, many tensors to having just eventually just one tensor, and now we will contract this tensor, okay, the final tensor, we contract it, and this gives us an approximate calculation of the partition function. Okay, and it's approximate because in this step we will be truncating this Smith, the singular values. We'll be throwing away very small ones, but of course we're making an approximation. Okay, hope this is clear. So let's get started. Actually, the algorithm is very, very simple. This is known as Tensor Renormalization Group, or TRG. And this was proposed by Michael Levin, by Levin and Nave back in 2006, so more than 10 years ago. And it was really a very important step in our ability to compute partition functions without resorting to sampling. So two steps. It has two steps. The first one is, at some point, you have your tensor network full of tensors. So let's take one of these tensors. And let's split it. Split it meaning let's apply a singular value decomposition as we discussed yesterday. Right? We'll regard this. If we want to cut it this way, it means that we regard these two indices as one, these two indices as one. So now this is a matrix, and we apply a singular value decomposition. Okay? So the first step is that we split the tensor, its tensor, into two. And then this index connecting the two will be very thick in the sense that will contain many values in principle. But we'll have a look at these singular values. We'll have a look, and if the whole thing is flat, if all the singular values are roughly the same, we are not allowed to touch that, okay? Because if we would simplify, if we would truncate the singular values, we would introduce a sizable error. But if we see that the singular values decay fast, then we know that it's okay to remove, say, these four singular values here, introducing an error at the order of 10 to the minus 6, okay? Compared to what we keep. So the first step then is to split the tensors. We take the tensor and we apply an SVD and possibly truncate to simplify this index. And we're going to do this in two different ways. We can also take the same tensor and break it in this direction. And I'm just drawing the same, so singular value decomposition, possibly truncation. Okay? We don't decide whether we can truncate or not. I mean, we have to look at the singular values. And if they tell you, hey, you can truncate me, you go ahead, but otherwise you shouldn't do it. Very good. So that was step one. We just split the tensors and possibly truncate. And then, yeah, question?
Sorry, just a quick clarification. Does that mean that you do it in both ways?
Or you will do it in those both ways, and you'll see why in a second. But yes, you do it in both ways. OK? So step number two, we'll collect pieces of these truncated tensors, and we'll put them together, okay, in this combination. So that means we take. So each of these tensors that you see here, these are triangles, they have three indices, right? Rank three tensors. We'll put together four of them in this way, okay? And we'll contract these indices, meaning we'll sum over these indices, and we'll end up with a single tensor with four open legs, right? And that's going to be, again, a blue ball, but with the indices going in these directions, okay? So why are we doing this? Well, let's put these things. Oh, sorry. Let me first discuss the cost of doing this. So each index here has some dimension. Initially, the dimension is 2 spin up down, okay, because originally coming from spin up down. But as we iterate, this bond dimension starts growing. And so what's the bond dimension? It's whatever the number of singular values that we keep after truncating. Okay, we will throw away the small ones, but we'll keep some number. So let's call this number chi. Chi here, okay? And the cost of these operations is gross, the computational cost, the time that the computer needs to run for, is the sixth power of this number that we keep, the number of singular values we keep. Okay, from now on, chi, this letter, is kept to denote the number of singular values we keep after truncating. Okay, so the objects that we keep, or this object, for instance, is going to be chi to the 4. Right, this tensor has 4 indices, each one takes chi values. So this tensor here that we are storing has chi to the 4 different values. Okay, the memory you need to allocate in your computer is chi to the 4. The time that it takes to get it is chi to the 6. Okay, very good. So with this scaling, the typical values we can do nowadays is with our laptop is chi to the equal to 100. So you would keep the first 100 singular values. Here it's only 10. Well, we could keep 100. Okay. So even if this decays slower than that, maybe by the time we get to 100, the singular values are very small already. Okay. This afternoon you'll be playing with chi equal to 20 just to make things fast and prevent problems with the laptop if you're not ready for it, but this is the type of values that we can get. Very good. And then, right, so that's what I said, that this chi is then the one dimension. It tells you how large these tensors are. Okay, is that clear? Because now what I'm going to do is I'm going to see what happens when we compose these two steps in the full tensor network representing the partition function. So this is your partition function, and what I say is that now this was maybe initially the exact representation, so we're going to break each of the tensors according to these lines. Okay, this tensor will break it in this direction, this in this direction, and so on. So if you look carefully, if you make the replacements from the previous slide, I will see that, for instance, yeah, this breaks into two pieces, and this is one of the pieces that we get. There is another piece coming from this one, and so on. So when you do that local replacement, you'll get two. That your tensor network has been converted into this. This could be an exact representation if these indices were thick. Okay, these indices were thick, but we assume that we have truncated them. So this is now an approximate representation of the original partition function. And then we're just going to contract these 4 and 4 and 4 into new tensors. Okay. And we get a new representation of the partition function, which is tilde. Okay. But don't worry about this being tilted. It's just the number you wanted represented in a different way. So this is one step. Okay, it's very simple. Remember, what we have to do was all here. Split the tensors, join the tensors. Repeat. Okay. And now what I wanted was to go from, say, n times n to n half times n half. But what I've told you is how to go from n times n to a square root, well, some different number. With a tensor network, then now it's tilde, and you just iterate once, right? If you tilde something and tilt it again, you go to what you wanted. Okay, so this is how we're going to constrain the tensor network. It's as simple as this: two basic steps and iterate. Okay, very good. And how many times do we want to be doing this? So, well, we wanted we start with n times n, and every time we do two. We compose such iterations, right? We go horizontal, tilde, horizontal. So let's let this be one step, and another. So you realize that in these double steps, what we have is we're dividing the linear size by 2. And so you do this log to n steps, and you're done. You have converted your tensor network for the partition function into an approximate tensor network made of one tensor. Okay, so you're ready to contract the indices and get your approximation to the partition function. Okay, I hope this is clear because we are doing this afternoon. Okay, it's not a threat, but it's still true. All right, so yeah, question?
So this is possible only if you can do this cutting off in the truncation at every point.
Very good. Actually, you can always do this, whether you truncate or not. But if you don't truncate, the bond dimension grows exponentially, right? So you'll have to stop just because your computer takes too long or there is no enough memory to store the objects.
So practically, you'll stop when your truncations are possible.
We'll see that. We'll see that in some cases, truncation allows you to go on forever. Okay? So we'll see this in a minute. But otherwise, you should stop when the truncation is telling you, oh, you have to keep that much. Otherwise, you're going to lose your partition function. Yes. So you, yeah. Very good. Any other question? Okay. So now let's think about the cost of doing this. So what we said is that each iteration was order chi to the 6, okay, one dimension to the 6th power. And we have to do this log n times. So this is the cost. Okay? If you fix the one dimension to, say, 20 or 100, then the total cost of computing this partition function is logarithmic, scales logarithmically in the system size. Okay? That's pretty good. Okay? We went from exponential in the system size to logarithmic in the system size. So now you can deal with very large partition functions. Okay? That's if you fix the one dimension here. Now the question is whether you are allowed to fix the one dimension, or whether this one dimension should grow as you coarse grain, and, right? So we cannot postulate what's going to happen. We have to ask the system whether we can truncate or not. And now I'll do that. Very good. So this is the algorithm, and this is the cost. Okay, the one dimension that you have here depends on how much error you are willing to accept. And this is it. Okay, questions? Because if there are no questions, we'll start looking at what happens when we use this algorithm. Good. So let's have a look at what happens if we take the IZ model of criticality. Okay, beta different from beta critical. What I'm going to do is, well, I ran this simulation already. You'll do it this afternoon. So what we have here is I'm going to show you as a function of the iterations, right? So we iterate this method, we get tensor A prime, A double prime. Okay. So I want to have a look at these tensors. And how do I have a look at these tensors? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to break this tensor into two pieces, and I'm going to look at the singular values. This is the quantity that you want to be looking anyway at, because that's what decides whether you can truncate or not. Okay. So this is what happens if you choose, say, beta equal to 0.8. Yeah, 0.8. So the critical one would be 0.4406 or something, right? So this is twice, almost twice as large as the critical beta. Okay. Then what we see is that when we start, there are only a couple of singular values. So after one step of coarsegraining, this object is very simple. The singular values that it has, well, are order 1, a couple of them, and order 10 to the minus 1, and then the rest are equal to numerical 0. Okay, so, but as we coarse grain, this tensor becomes more complicated. It has more singular values that are non-zero, and you see this after one, after two coarse grain steps, after three, and so on. Okay, but what you really should be paying attention to is that it doesn't matter whether this is changing or not. You go to say 15 or less than 15 singular values, and you're at 10 to the minus 4 already. Okay, so you can safely chop off the rest. And the errors that you're making are below 10 to the minus 4. Okay? And if you want a smaller error, keep a few more singular values. Okay? Yes?
It's interesting. It looks like that the further singular values sort of align to one specific value.
Yeah.
Is there an understandable reason for it?
So actually, all the structure, there is no coincidence here. This is an integral model, right? There is a lot of structure. We're not using any of this structure. But of course, when you do things properly, this structure comes back at you. Okay? So we are not exploiting this. We could do the same with a non-integral model, and that structure might not be there. Okay, but that's OK. I mean, yes, there are deep reasons. This is the IZ model. The reasons why you get these plateaus is because it's an integral model. But that's not going to play any role here. We're just using the IZ model because it's the simplest one, the one that we can make contact or compare with other methods and so on. Question?
So you're making an error of 10 to the minus 4 at each tensor you split.
Yes.
How do the errors add up? So if you have an n by n system, there must be.
So that you have n square such errors.
Yeah, and then the error goes like 10 to the minus 4 times n squared? Or? Mm-hmm.
And now you do this every step. So you need to, the first step, you made an error 10 to the minus 4 times n squared. The next step, you do an error, say, 10 to the minus 4 again. But now it's not n squared, but n over 2 squared. right? And you add all these contributions. And if you, at some point, become worried that this is too large, the sum of these errors is too large, just go to 10 to the minus 8. Yes. OK? But yes, these are the right things to be thinking about. Okay? Now, this error is to be on the safe side. Actually, that doesn't mean that expectation values will come with this error. Expectation values, local, say, magnetization and so on, typically come with much smaller errors than that one. But this gives you an upper bound to whatever errors you're going to be making. Okay? Yeah. Very good. So, few silly observations. Singular values decay very fast. Okay? No matter which plot we look at, they are decaying exponentially fast. As we look at the increasing singular value, it's right. We've organized them from large to small. As we label them, as you move from the first to the second and so on, the values decay exponentially. Okay? So great, this is perfect for truncation. Okay? Second, the spectrum seems to converge to a fixed spectrum, right? First it changes, but now if you compare these two, they look very, very similar. And actually, if I keep iterating, I'll get back the same spectrum. So in the fourth lecture, we'll talk about RG flow, but you start seeing that something is converging here. We have the spectrum of singular values seems to be converging as we coarse grain more and more. Okay? We'll talk more about that. And finally, the last observation is that we can iterate forever. Okay? We can keep going. The one dimension here, say 15, was enough to make such a small mistake, an error. Okay? So you can keep doing that. All right, so this was low temperature, now high temperature, or beta below critical beta. You'll have a different structure of singular values, but they share the features that I just discussed. They decay very fast. They seem to be converged to constant spectrum, and therefore we can, and very sharp spectrum, and we can iterate this. Okay? So now at these temperatures, you tell me, oh, I have a partition function of, you know, a million times a million spins. Well, no problem. We can compute it using this. Okay. Good. The cause was this. So, and remember that this is all happening because of this area law, partition function version of the area law. Very good. So let's not get overexcited, though, because what we want typically is challenging problems, and the critical point will be more challenging. Let's see what happens when we try to deal with a critical partition function. Okay. So again, this time, well, I'm plotting basically again the same type of information. So what you have here is the spectrum of singular values after 2 iterations, 3 iterations, 4 iterations, 8 iterations. Okay. What you see this time is first that there are many more singular values, counting all the way to 10 to the minus 4. There are more, and they grow. The number of them grows with iteration. Okay. So that tells you that if you want to keep some fixed accuracy, you have to increase the bond dimension. Okay? You have to keep more and more of those guys as you coarse grain more and more. So the singular values do not decay as fast as before, but they are still very far from being a flat spectrum. There is nothing flat about this. Okay? This is still decaying. So we can still exploit this property. We can still truncate these tensors and go to very large system sizes. All I'm saying is that it's not as nice as when we were off criticality. Now, with each iteration, the complexity, the bond dimension you need to keep, must be larger. So the cost is going to be larger. So you cannot iterate forever. Okay? At some point, you hit the computational resources that are available to you. So, and so what we see in this case also is that this is not converging to a fixed point spectrum. Okay? It's not converging. It's going. This spectrum looks different than this, and this, and this, and so on. And you would see that you would never converge to a fixed point spectrum. And as I said, each iteration is more expensive. Now let's try to assess how expensive this is getting. So remember, the cost of one step is chi to the 6, chi being the bond dimension of the tensors. Now you can assess that the bond dimension that you need grows exponentially. If you want to keep the same accuracy, the one dimension that you need grows exponentially with the iteration. Okay? Remember also that the number of spins you are considering also grows exponentially with the iteration, so it's not so bad, but still. What the implication is that the cost of this algorithm grows exponentially with the iteration. Okay? So the first iterations are very cheap. you can keep constraining, but slow down exponentially fast. All right? So we can get to very large system sizes compared to not using this method, but there is a limit. Very good. So far we've been talking. Are there questions about this? This is basically the general remarks. I wanted to explain you how the method is implemented. You'll do it this afternoon yourself, and then I've also anticipated what you will see in terms of performance when you deal with non-critical and critical partition functions. Are there questions about that?
Yeah, can we use this to locate the phase transition, or is that inefficient?
You could use this, and yeah, you could run this for. The answer is yes, but it doesn't follow from what I explained. Right? So you can use this method to locate the phase transition if you didn't know where the phase transition was. But because the spectrum of singular values is sensitive to the critical point, you could kind of use that. But there are better things you can do if your goal specifically is to locate the phase transition. Within the same TRG method, you could just look at other quantities. Question?
Does that mean that the bond dimension accounts for the fact that it grows with time steps? It means that it's accounting for more long range order.
More long range correlations.
Yes,
correlations
between.
Remember that the area law in one dimension in quantum systems, the area law was replaced by a logarithmic correction. Well, this is the logarithmic correction in action, right there. Yes. Very good. Yes. So if you actually can associate some entropy to this distribution, and you'll see that it grows as a log. Yeah. As a log of the size, but because the size is doubling of the every time, so it's growing linearly in the coherent step. Okay, very good. Any other question? Good. So partition function, who cares in the end? It's just a number, right? What we really want are, say, expectation values, magnetization, two-point correlators, and other things. So let me just give you an idea of how this goes. If you want to compute, say, we discussed how to compute the partition function, but how about, say, we take one spin, and now we want to measure whether it's pointing up, down, on average, right? We have a thermal ensemble, and we want to take a thermal average to that. How do we do this? Well, actually, we just write a new tensor network, okay? Where, say, this was the spin 1, so we're going to go and replace the first tensor with 1, where the different values are weighted by up or down, plus 1 or minus 1. So the idea is that the same way that we encoded the partition function in a tensor network, we can encode also this expectation value in a different tensor network. Now, this second tensor network looks the same as the first one, except in the spin where we want to measure the magnetization, okay? And then, of course, we need to, the expectation value is divided by the partition function. So we need to take the ratio of these two tensor networks. And basically, you compute this one, you compute that one, and you're done. Now, I've explained how to compute this one. The computation of this one is essentially equivalent, except that now all the tensors are not the same. So the singular values that you have to do will depend on where you are. Okay? So it's a bit more complicated. If you understand the principles of how to compute this, the rest follow by generalizing in a simple way. But for the sake of simplicity, we don't explain in detail how to do that. Okay, but it's very clear. It's just another tensor network with the same structure, just that there is a different tensor right there. Okay.
But the answer will be zero.
The answer will be zero, even if you had symmetry breaking. You'll have the average of the two options: all the spins up, all the spins down. In this case. But actually, we'll see that the tensor itself, when you do this, there are ways we will not see. I'm just going to claim that what happens is that as you cross-grain long enough, your tensors, if you are in the symmetry breaking phase, you can see that they break into direct sum of two contributions. And you keep one of the two contributions, and then that was the spin-up contribution. And then you can evaluate the magnetization. If you wanted the other one, which is identical, you can also evaluate it. So yes, if you don't break explicitly the Z2 symmetry, even in this spontaneously broken symmetry break broken phase, you'll have that you are averaging over spins up, all spins up, and all spins down. And so the magnetization is going to be zero, as you said. Okay? But within this framework, you can also split the two contributions separately and then estimate the magnetization. Very good. And what about the correlator? Well, use your imagination, right? Just put two insertions. You know, you just decide how many insertions you want to put. Put different tensors there, and that's it. Just contract this new tensor network. Okay? Question.
A row where you put sigma 1 and sigma 7. So is there some distance on your graph that you can?
Right. I decided that this is 1 because I count from here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I just, you know, you choose whatever spins you want, mm-hmm. and just make sure you put the red tensors in the right place. Yeah. There is no, this is just meaning an arbitrary pair of spins. Yes. Okay. And if you want 3-point correlators, go ahead.
Okay, this I understand. But can you find fall off of these correlation functions depending on where you put the index of the second sigma?
Can you compute this?
Yes,
yes, you can compute this.
Just using kind of Euclidean kind of distance function on this slide.
Yeah, the data distance.
No, I mean, that has nothing to do with tensor networks.
No,
you just decide.
That was all the questions about.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, so given a lattice, you decide which 2-point correlators you are interested in for whatever reasons. And the translation here is that you just replace the corresponding blue balls with red, or blue tensors with red tensors, and contract.
Yep. There's a distance on the
distance
graph.
Or metric behind all of this.
This.
Yes, there's a distance.
I mean, I don't know, but that's a property of the partition function of the IZ model.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with whether you use tensor networks or not for that. Is that? Okay. Very good. So we're doing well with time. I'm surprised. So. And now I have two comments. So we're basically done with two dimensions, okay? And now I just want to make a couple of comments. So how about three dimensions, okay? It's very nice to draw things. I like it. So you can draw in two, in three, but I want to analyze. So there is a three-dimensional generalization of TRG, okay? But there is a problem with it. So first, let me say that I want to talk about three dimensions, but let me go back to two and just say that whatever we're doing, all these manipulations are essentially equivalent. They are not the same, but they're essentially equivalent to getting two tensors, okay, putting them together and squeezing the resulting index. Okay, these two indices, squeezing them into one, squeezing these two indices into one by using some singular value decomposition, okay, and truncating that. So this is not how we are doing things. This is not how you're going to program this this afternoon. But I'm saying it's equivalent to doing that. And doing it in the x direction, and then you do it in the y direction. Okay? And as you iterate this, you are squeezing your lattice in the x direction, then in the y direction. You are constraining one direction, then the other. You could do that. And you would get qualitatively equivalent results as the original TRG method. Now, the reason why I'm rephrasing it into x direction and y direction across gratings is that then I can tell you how I would go about doing three dimensions. Okay? In three dimensions, just, well, squeeze in one direction, squeeze in the other direction, and then there are three, no? So do it in three directions. So let me have a look at this. What I'm saying now is that if we want to put, so the tensor network now, the partition function, can be written exactly in terms of a tensor network where each tensor now has six indices, okay, one per nearest neighbor. And when we try to contract this tensor network, well, we could take two tensors and put them together. Two tensors that are on the same x-axis, nearest neighbor on the x-axis, and we could put them together. And we could squeeze the indices, okay, through some singular value decomposition and then truncation. And and that would produce a new tensor also with six indices. And now we could take the resulting tensor network made of these tensors and squeeze them pairwise in the y direction, okay? And finally in the z direction, okay? No magic, we can do that. What I did was I just drew things in 2D where we've seen that the algorithm performs very well. I drew a natural generalization in three dimensions, okay? So drawing-wise, no problem. But the problem really is can we squeeze, can we truncate these indices, right? This was always the question. We don't decide on that. We have to ask, we look at the singular values, the relevant singular values to this question, and we look at whether they are flat or decaying sharply. Okay? That's the basic rule. That's the one that you, that's the time where you ask the physical system, hey, can I compress or not? Okay? And the problem then is that, as we discussed, in three dimensions, there is this this partition function version of the entanglement entropy variable for quantum states, whatever, that says that the entropy is growing linearly. So if you consider a block of L times L times L tensors, and you want to replace this with a single tensor, okay, there is an entropy attached to these indices that is growing linearly in the size of the block, okay, the linear size of the block. So in one dimension less, this was a constant. This entropy was a constant. It was not growing with the size of the block. Now it's growing with the size of the block. Okay? So what that means is that these tensors can be compressed, but not as much as in two dimensions. Okay? Specifically, if the cost of the one dimension that you would need would be exponential, grow exponential in L, and before you notice, that means that you have an exponential growth. The cost would grow exponentially in the linear size of the block that you're trying to compress. Okay? You take this region, you want to replace all these tensors inside with a single tensor. Well, the effective bond index, okay, is going to be exponential in the linear size of this block. So what that means actually is that if you try to coarse grain, the cost will grow doubly exponentially in the iteration step. Okay? And you know, there are really brave people, including Clement, are you here? Okay, what happened to you in recent months? So you tried to apply these things in three dimensions, right? Mm-hmm. And you saw that, the one dimension. It's hard to keep up because in addition, the cost of the algorithm is a large power of the one dimension.
So, yeah, it doesn't converge as quickly in one dimension.
Yeah. Okay, so it's... It's a very interesting research direction, but it's a challenging one. And progress needs to be made before we can call victory there. Okay? So three dimensions is not impossible, but it's work in progress. All right. So that's basically everything I wanted to say about the algorithm, okay? In this lecture number three. I have 6 minutes. We can either go for questions, or I can tell you about the transfer metrics. So maybe questions first. Good. So I'm going to use this last 6 minutes to tell you about something that you started computing yesterday. Remember that yesterday, Clement told us to get some of these tensors. We're back to two dimensions. And we computed the transfer metric like this. Okay, we were putting the tensors AAA, say four of them, and we were encouraged to ask what are the eigenvalues of this. So let me justify why it is interesting to compute this. Okay, so now I'm back in two dimensions, and I want to show you something that, you know, Monte Carlo. Monte Carlo is a wonderful method, and one of the things I like about Monte Carlo is that Monte Carlo doesn't care too much whether you are in two dimensions, three dimensions, and so on. Okay. Tensor networks, if you go from two dimensions to three dimensions, you go from knowing what you do to, you know, wild territory. So work needs to be done there. So Monte Carlo is automatically usable in four dimensions, if you care, and so on. Okay, five, and so on. Tensor networks, not yet. But tensor networks come also with advantages. And in two dimensions, this is one thing you can do that it would be probably very hard with Monte Carlo or a method. So this is one application. Remember that the partition function, we've written it in two dimensions as this tensor network. And now if you look carefully at this tensor network, you could arbitrarily decide that, well, that there is some object here that is being repeated many times, n times. Okay? So that your partition function is nothing but the trace of these indices with those, of n times, 1, 2, 3, n times, this transfer matrix. Okay? So m to the n. You take the transfer matrix, this transfer matrix here, you multiply it. You say, I call this a matrix. It's a matrix from, say, the upper indices to the lower indices. Okay, if you were to join all these indices together and all these indices together, you would get just two indices, the upper one and the lower one, and that would be a matrix, right? So let me call this transfer matrix. And what I'm saying is that this transfer matrix, if you take the nth power of it, right, you have here 1, 2, 3, all the way to n, and you take the trace, you get the partition function. Okay? So this transfer matrix is clearly related to the partition function. You can compute the partition function from this transfer matrix. Now, we have this partition, this transfer matrix, and we also have one more thing. We could decide that we shift all these indices by 1. This is like a translation operator. Okay? It's just something you can do. You take all your spins and move them to the left, and by periodic boundary to the right. By periodic boundary conditions, the last one goes to the beginning. Okay, so here you have two operators. It's very easy to show that they commute with each other. They are, again, I insist, they are matrices regarded as taking something that lives in the tensor product of all these indices. Okay, they map as, say, a vector living in the tensor product of all these indices into a vector living in here, and here the same. It's a map from the upper indices to the lower indices. And you can see that because this is made of copies of the same tensor, well, it commutes with just shifting around the indices. Okay? So you have two matrices that commute. Okay? And you could ask what are the eigenvalues, and you know, that's something that you started doing yesterday. You started looking at the eigenvalues of this transfer matrix. Now, why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting in general for many reasons, but let me focus on one particular case where this is very clear. At the critical point, the partition function that we're talking about, this square tensor network, okay, happens to be very close to some universal object, the partition function of the conformal field theory. Okay? So at the critical point, the Ising model is described by the Ising conformal field theory, the Ising CFT, where probably you know about these things. Let me first say that the partition function we get on the lattice is not exactly the one that we get in the continuum. Obviously, there are finite size corrections. But similarly, the transfer matrix that we get on the lattice, so this guy here, is closely related to a continuum object, okay, a transfer matrix for the CFT. And the interesting thing is that this transfer matrix has a lot of useful information. So we are talking about the continuous phase transition, right? We are looking at the critical Ising model. And there is this CFT, this conformal field theory, that it's describing the universal properties, actually, of this phase transition. So in the following sense, in the phase transition, what you care is about mostly about the universal properties, say the critical exponents. Okay, you will like, if I tell you this is a critical point, the first natural question is, what are the critical exponents? Okay? So it turns out that this is encoded in terms of the CFT in what's called the conformal data, and this comes in the name of, say, things like scaling dimensions of operators and conformal spins of operators. Okay? So if you know about CFT, you know what I'm saying. If you don't worry. These are just labels for something that we would like to compute. Okay? We would like to compute the scaling dimensions and conformal spins. Now, what's nice about this transfer matrix, the transfer matrix for the CFT, is that its eigenvalues, the eigenvalues of this transfer matrix for the CFT, are actually given directly by the exponential of these scaling dimensions. And this translation operator, the eigenvalues are given by the exponential of the conformal spins. Okay? So this universal data that will give rise to all the critical exponents and everything we care about of the phase transition, this information is actually encoded in this transfer matrix of the CFT. Okay? But now what I'm saying is that on the lattice, we already have a lattice version of that. We have an object that is very similar to this one. It's similar to this one up to finite size corrections. Right? So in the end, what I'm saying is that on the lattice, you have these two objects. And let's focus on the transfer matrix, which is what you did yesterday. What I'm saying is that if you look at the eigenvalues of this transfer matrix, from it, you might be able to estimate these scaling dimensions. What we would like is to compute these scaling dimensions. Okay? Our goal is to extract this universal information, and it's encoded in these scaling dimensions by comparison with the CFT. So our goal is to use these lattice values, right, these eigenvalues of these transfer metrics, we want to use those to extract these scaling dimensions. That's our goal. And our problem is that on the lattice, the values we want come with finite size corrections, right? This is a universal parameter that we want to extract, but this is not under control. It's something that depends on the particular lattice realization. But what we know is that these corrections are smaller and smaller as we consider larger and larger system sizes. So our goal, well, our problem is to deal with these finite size corrections. So the larger the partition function on the lattice, the larger this partition function is, okay, the better, because these corrections are suppressed with 1 over the linear size of the lattice. So we would like to study very large lattices. We would like to build this partition function not for 8 spins, but for 100, okay, so that these corrections are suppressed. Okay, so this is the motivation. We know that from this transfer metrics, there is valuable information to be extracted, but this valuable information has corrections which decay with the system size, so we would like to consider as large systems as possible. Now, if we just use, if we don't use any trick, we can go to system sizes that maybe your computer can handle, say 20, 30 spins, linear size. Okay, but if we use TRG, if we use this coherent transformation, then effectively we can go to much larger system sizes, on the order of hundreds, possibly thousands. Okay, so this is one of the applications that it's not very clear how you would do with other methods. We can actually access the transfer metrics of the partition function and extract the universal information at criticality. Very good. And now it's time for a break. So after the break, we'll see. We'll have a look at the TRG from a renormalization group perspective.